You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here, and welcome to the show. It is 9/11. We're going to get into that today. A lot of news going on, the president's speech last night, other things that we're going to get into. But before I do, just a couple of quick announcements, as it were. I want to let you know that OptimaTaxRelief.com is a proud underwriter of the Tom Hartman Program. Facing back taxes, IRS liens, bank levies, people can find more information on OptimaTaxRelief.com. We're also pleased to announce some new major markets added to our non-commercial affiliate list. These include KNSJFM 89.1 in San Diego, KBBFFM 89.1 in San Francisco, KBCSFM 91.3 in Seattle. Of course, our KTPK in Los Angeles, the largest FM in the United States, and largest radio station in the United States, arguably. And soon to be heard in Portland, once again, on KXRY-FM 91.1. And our non-commercial affiliates, our Pacifica affiliates, and Free Speech TV are an important part of our show. So all that said, welcome to the program. And last night the president gave his speech. One of the people who has been keeping close track on this situation, in fact, his call tallies have been showing up regularly over Democratic Underground and other places as he's tweeted them out, is one of the founders, certainly one of the ringleaders of the Progressive Caucus in the House of Representatives, one of the senior members and most influential, and one of my favorite members, arguably my favorite member of the U.S. House of Representatives. I remember when Bernie Sanders and I started doing this show, when Bernie started showing up on the show, and I lived in Vermont back 10 years ago, Bernie said, "You got to get to know Peter DeFazio. He's the smartest guy in Congress." Well, he's with us. Congressman DeFazio, welcome back.
Thanks for that introduction. Actually, just chatted with Bernie last night, and we're going to get together for dinner next week.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
He genuinely did say that. He was like, you know, he's the only guy you need to know in the House. You know, and this is when he was your colleague in the House.
Sometimes that's not to an advantage around here to know too much.
Yeah, well, yeah. Anyhow, how DeFazio, D-E-F-A-Z-I.
Someone said that to me, actually. Like, they said, you know, you read too much.
Yeah, okay. DeFazio.house.gov is the website. So, Congressman, I'm curious your thoughts on, you know, the arc of this previous week, on what the president had to say last night. And, you know, this is a perfect opportunity to even bring 9/11 to the conversation, since this is the anniversary of it.
Well, I don't think one could describe it as an arc. I mean, an arc to me is somewhat delicate, or, you know, I mean, it has sort of symmetry. I wouldn't say that the White House position on why, how, and to what extent we should attack Syria has followed an arc. I'd say it's more like a series of jagged ups and downs, and then a few turns and twists and changes of direction.
It's a bad etch-a-sketch.
Yeah, a little bit more like an etch-a-sketch. You know, one of the most interesting things, I just, you know, there's so much information, it's always hard to keep track of, but I just got today, finally, a copy of a letter to Senator Levin, written by General Dempsey before all of this took place, pointing to the pitfalls and problems of military action in Syria, and talking about it being an act of war, obviously, and then talking about unintended effects and spillovers and things that they aren't talking about anymore.
Whoa. And General Dempsey is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, isn't he?
He is. Some would observe in the last briefing we were in with him that his body language looked somewhat uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I mean, people who've actually been through wars. Colin Powell was actually through a war. Dwight Eisenhower had been through a war. Jack Kennedy had been through a war. His PT boat was cut in half. They have always been far more reluctant to pump their chests and call out the dogs of war. And well, anyway,
in this case, you know, I would say that the Congress is pretty darn reluctant, particularly particularly the House. You know, I got to give the president credit that he decided to come to Congress, because actually I just reintroduced my fix to the War Powers Act today. Mm-hmm. A previous Congress, 1974, in reaction to Nixon's illegal bombing of Cambodia, passed the War Powers Act. Unfortunately, there was a House version, a Senate version, and the weaker version won out, which allows any president to attack anybody, anytime, and then just inform Congress afterwards and ask retroactively for authority. We need to fix that. You know, so in this case, actually, Obama, under the law as written by Congress, which I do not believe is a true interpretation of the Constitution and War Powers, could go forward without authority. He chose to come to Congress. Give him credit for that. But I don't support the mission as explained, and don't believe it's going to resolve the issues. And one of the issues Dempsey talks about in his letter is, well, what if one of our objectives was to go after his chemical weapons stockpile? Collateral damage, big problem, couldn't get all of it, would be tremendously expensive, would require massive effort on the part of the U.S., none of which is what's being talked about here. And then you have them saying, well, we're not taking sides in the Civil War, we're not going to get involved, except John McCain put language in the Senate version of the bill that is essentially disguised, we want regime change. So, it's all very problematic. I'm really pushing and hoping, and a lot of other people around here are now too, that this diplomatic effort works out.
Yeah, plus this administration, correct me if I'm wrong, right now, I believe with the authority of Congress, is arming the rebels, which includes, although they're uncomfortable with the reality of this, which includes members of al-Qaeda, the people who are fighting against, maybe they're not arming al-Qaeda, but the rebels, the generic rebels, the large R rebels, includes al-Qaeda.
Well, there's al-Nusra, al-Qaeda offshoots, affiliates, allies. I mean, there's an incredibly eclectic group. I got to be careful what I say. I read in the newspaper that we are training some people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've read that too, I would say that's taking a position in a civil war. I think we're already up to our hips in a civil war.
Right. I've never seen anything quite like this, I got to tell you, in terms of spontaneous opposition.
Yeah.
Not a big organized phone-in campaign, email campaign,
right,
petitions. I've had now 3,571 calls, 71 in favor.
Wow. Wow. Now, we just have a minute left. We're talking with Congressman Peter DeFazio of Oregon. And Congressman, thoughts on 9/11, on the anniversary of 9/11?
Well, the Republicans do like to make a big deal out of Benghazi, which was a screw-up. They don't admit that they were also somewhat culpable, since for years they've been cutting the security budget for the State Department, embassies overseas. But anyway, be that as it may, but if they're going to, sort of bang on Benghazi as, are this president making us vulnerable to attack? What about George Bush and not reading the memo from Condoleezza Rice about, the chatter and the potential of an imminent attack on the U.S.? So, it was a very, very sad thing that happened. It's led to both initially some intended consequences, go after al-Qaeda, the Taliban, Osama bin Laden, and unintended consequences, Bush diverting us into Iraq, which was a disaster, and now the extended nation-building effort in Afghanistan, which isn't going well either.
Right. Congressman Peter DeFazio, always great to have you with us, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
DeFazio.house.gov is his website. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Peter DeFazio, one of the great guys in the House of Representatives. We'll be right back with a word from Jerry Falwell. Fair and only slightly unbalanced, Tom Hartman here with you. You need to know this. On September 11th, 2001, which is what, 12 years ago today? Our nation was attacked by a small group of people, perhaps fewer than 100. They were financed by the son of a Saudi oil sheikh, who we had supported for years, fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan when we helped him organize what was then called the Mujahideen and today is known as Al-Qaeda. This large attack by a small group of people, really what it did was it provoked more than a decade. I mean, here we have, 11 years on, of national insanity here in the United States. Two completely unnecessary wars, an ongoing involvement in the Middle East that is destroying our national honor. It's killing off our soldiers and Marines and wounding them in record numbers and depleting our coffers. It was not another nation that attacked us on 9/11. It was not an act of war. It was more like when Tim McVeigh blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City, hoping to repeat the scenario played out in the novel The Turner Diaries, where a federal building was bombed and the government so overreacted that it took away all the guns from the good Christian white people. In that novel, which continues to inspire militia and Tea Party members across the country, those good white people rose up, killed off the government and all the Jews, Catholics, and people of color, and America once again became the white Anglo-Saxon Christian nation that it was at its founding. Well, Tim McVeigh tried to play out the Turner Diaries, and he failed. President Bill Clinton tracked him down, arrested him, convicted him, and put him to death even. The stateless criminals. Osama bin Laden, his passport had been pulled by the Saudis. He literally was stateless. He had been deported to Sudan because he had tried to attack Saddam Hussein, Iraq. And Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is a Pakistani, I believe, were hoping to produce such a huge response from the United States that we would be drawn into their battle in the Middle East, their battle against secular governments like Iraq, like that of Saddam Hussein's. They wanted us to help them turn those secular states like Iraq into Islamic religious states. They succeeded. Bin Laden said he would drain America economically. He did. Bin Laden won, round one anyway, of all this, because of the essential naivete and stupidity of the Bush-Cheney administration and that schoolboy, chest-thumping, testosterone-driven response of George W. Bush to the crime, and make no mistake, it was a crime. It was not an act of war. It was not another nation. The crime of 9/11. And that was and is no way to run a nation's foreign policy. 9/11 should remind us that there will probably be future attacks on the United States, God forbid. Hopefully none will be as big as 9/11, but it's not inconceivable. So the conversation we should be having today about how to respond in the future when non-state actors like Bin Laden or Tim McVeigh commit horrific crimes of violence against America and Americans is really the conversation that's necessary. We should be strengthening international institutions for justice and policing, institutions like Interpol and the International Criminal Court at The Hague. These actually would have been the appropriate responses to Bin Laden. And frankly, I mean, the reality here is most of the world was expecting us to use Interpol and the Criminal Court at The Hague at the time on 9/11. I mean, there was a candlelight vigil in downtown Tehran, Iran, in solidarity with and support of the United States the day after 9/11. Afghanistan offered to arrest Bin Laden on behalf of America and turn him over to an impartial third nation for a trial. But George W. Bush refused because, as he told his biographer, Mickey Herskowitz, he so wanted to be a war president. In 1999, Herskowitz was writing his autobiography, and Bush told Herskowitz that being a war president would give him the political capital necessary to privatize Social Security. And it nearly worked. You'll recall when he was reelected in 2004, the first thing he tried to do in 2005 with his new term was privatize Social Security. We should never again allow such a thing, a president using a terrorist attack to get us into phony wars so that he can enrich his bankster buddies. We should never again let that happen. 9/11 is also a time for us to reflect on the legacy of the years of Bush insanity. It's time to put formally, officially, an end to the practice of extraordinary rendition, torture, and all this wildly excessive and unnecessary wiretapping and data gathering. It's time for us to reorganize our intelligence services to prosecute the people and the corporations who committed crimes from Abu Ghraib to Guantanamo. It's time to prosecute the war criminals in the Bush administration, who just 2 weeks ago, President Obama requested have full immunity from prosecution for war crimes. Why would he ask for that if he didn't know that they were guilty of something? It's time to rein in the defense contractors and end the practice of privatizing our military and our intelligence functions. No more Blackwaters, no more no-bid contracts for Halliburton. It's time to break up Homeland Security. In fact, let's stop using that word. That word came from Rudolf Hess, the number two guy in the Adolf Hitler administration. Homeland. Heimat, so saying. Let's return to a more rational and accountable system of policing and intelligence gathering, where different agencies have different mandates, and they hold each other accountable, and they act as checks and balances. I mean, this anniversary of 9/11 should both be a time of reflection and a time of action. We now have had enough time and distance from 9/11 to see the events clearly. It was a crime, not an act of war. The perpetrators were criminals, not noble warriors or soldiers, and we should have dealt with them the same way Bill Clinton dealt with Tim McVeigh. Arrested, convicted, sentenced. End of story, and closure achieved. So the next time, God forbid, an event like 9/11 or Oklahoma City happens, hopefully, the next time, we'll know how to conduct ourselves. I think the fact that we're capable of learning lessons is what we're seeing right now, where Obama comes and says, hey, I want to go bomb Syria, and Congress says, oh, wait a minute. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So what, in your mind, are the great lessons of 9/11? Today is the anniversary, and you can even speculate on the causes of 9/11 if you'd like. Plus, we're going to hear from Jerry Falwell. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Last night, old friend Alex Van Oss, who those of you who have been NPR listeners for decades will remember. Alex was, in fact, Alex, I think, produced a segment that we did from Uganda back in 1980 or 81 on Thanksgiving Day. I was in a famine region, and that was the Thanksgiving special for National Public Radio. And we've kept in touch over the years, and so anyhow, we were, last night he came over and watched the TV show, and we went out for dinner, and we were looking for a place where we could watch the president's speech. We went over to the Hamilton. We had called them, and they had said that they could put a TV on the president's speech. But when we got there, they said, no, we're going to watch soccer. And then we walked down to M&S to see if they maybe did, but they were out of business. We called over to Ellis Pizza, and they said, no, it's a soccer, big deal. So we were walking down F Street between 13th and 14th, which is in the neighborhood of the TV studios, just totally bummed out. And here's this little Italian restaurant that was, like, mostly empty. It's relatively new, that had MSNBC on their TV screen, and we walk in, and they're playing the audio over the sound system, getting ready for the president's speech. It was like, you know, just like dropped into our laps. And so we had a nice day, and they had a gluten-free pasta even. I mean, you know, it's like, so we had a very, very nice dinner and a great conversation, and we paused it to watch the president's speech. And my take on the president's speech is that it went something like this. My fellow Americans, poison gas is bad. I watched movies of little kids dying. I'm horrified. I've apparently never seen people die in war before because this totally grossed me out. I must not have seen people die of napalm. I've apparently never seen anybody shot, flopping around, screaming and squirting blood. I've apparently not ever been in a war zone or anywhere near one, because this video of people, you know, foaming at the mouth and dying within a matter of hours, so grossed me out that I think I need to drop missiles on Syria. And you need to watch it too, because it'll gross you out too. And then he went on to say, but I don't want to do it today. And in fact, I don't even want Congress to authorize it today, because maybe I can work out something with the Russians so that we can get this chemical stockpile under control. And if so, we'll have done it, because I was such a tough guy. That was my, oh, and by the way, Killing kids with gas is terrible. That was my takeaway from the message. I have to believe that the president has not seen the pictures of the children born with birth defects in Iraq as a result of depleted uranium. I mean, the library of those pictures now is huge. It's the highest birth defect rate in the world. And many of these children die on birth or die within the first year or two of birth. That he's not seen people die from gunshots. And dying from a gunshot, by the way, can take a week or two. I mean, it can take a long time, particularly if there's an infection and it's painful. Typically when people get shot, they just don't, you know, go and fall over. They scream, they flop around, depending on where they're hit, they're squirting blood or not. I mean, I don't get it with the poison gas thing. I mean, I do get it that, you know, we had thousands of people on the battlefield and the Germans dumped this poison gas back during World War I and like 6,000 people died all at once. And we said, hey, wait a minute. You know, we don't mind killing off soldiers one at a time with a gun or a bayonet. That's kind of sporting. But to kill 6,000 people with gas, that's not sporting. That's like saying, I'm going deer hunting today and I'm taking an AK-47. No, that's not sporting. I'm going duck hunting with my 50 caliber machine gun. No, it's not sporting. I don't think they make a 50 caliber machine gun, but you get my point. So you got to have a duck plug in your gun, and you got to have, I mean, there's rules, right? There's rules for killing and hunting, and there's rules for killing in war. And so we said, you know, if you can kill 6,000 people that fast, we're just not going to let that happen. And then the United States had been using napalm like crazy. Lawrence O'Donnell last night did what I thought was probably the best piece he's ever done in the history of his show on television, his last word. And it's worth going to lawrence.msnbc.com and watching Lawrence's last word segment from last night, because it's all about the use, the history of the United States inventing and using napalm, and how during the Reagan administration, the world was so horrified by our use of napalm that they said no. And the UN put out this treaty, and pretty much everybody signed it except us. Reagan didn't sign it. Clinton didn't sign it. Bush didn't sign it. Obama signed it on his first full day in office. Water boils at 100 degrees Celsius. Napalm burns at 800 degrees Celsius. Napalm burns through the skin and burns the muscles of living people. About a little less than half of the member of the people living in Dresden during World War II were bombed by our napalm. The residents of Tokyo during World War II were bombed by our napalm. We dropped hundreds of thousands of tons of napalm on Vietnam. I mean, there is no, what the president was basically saying last night, in my mind, was there's an appropriate way to kill people. And there's an inappropriate way to kill people. And I'm sorry, I don't buy that. You know, I get it that the generals want to have their rules of war. They want to say, hey, you know, you're going to fight a war, but we're not going to use our super weapons because that's just like, hey, the war might be over tomorrow. Right? You use a nuke or you use chemical weapons and all the soldiers are dead. And that war only lasted one day. That's no fun. We want the war needs to last a year or two so that people can work their way from lieutenant all the way to general. And you get a lot of battlefield promotions and you get ribbons and stars. And look at all this stuff on my chest when I'm on TV. I'm not being facetious. Rules of war. Come on. War is mass insanity. War is disorganized murder. There is no clean way to kill people. And we are encouraging war and violence in Syria by arming the rebels, including Al-Qaeda. And of that 100,000 people who have died, somewhere in the neighborhood of roughly half of them have died because we've been arming rebels who, like, cut people's beating hearts out and eat them on YouTube videos and shoot, you know, captured Assad's soldiers in the back of the head while they're whimpering with their faces on the ground with a foot on top of them on live YouTube videos. I mean, you want to watch YouTube videos? Watch those. Watch the rebel videos as well. I mean, sure, go ahead and watch. Absolutely. Watch the kids being gassed. And then look at the pictures of the kids in Iraq. And talk to somebody who's actually been in combat. There's no such thing as a good war. There may be a necessary war. You know, if you're attacked, you may need to fight back. There may be a necessary war, but there's no good war. So, anyhow, that's my rant on that. I also thought it was weird that the president last night noted that the last time there was a large-scale use of chemical weapons was when Saddam Hussein gassed the Iranians in the 1980s, and didn't mention the fact that President Ronald Reagan not only knew it was going on and supplied Saddam Hussein with satellite photos to tell him where to find the Iranians so that he could drop sarin gas on them. President Reagan did this. And we did nothing. We said, sure, go ahead. And did crossing that red line cause the whole world to start using chemical gas? No. And we sanctioned it. We helped it. And Reagan did nothing. Well, actually, he was proactive. He was on the side of dropping chemical weapons, poison gas. Why didn't Obama mention that last night? Well, it's the, you know, don't pick on previous Republican presidents thing. Glenn in Kettle Falls, Washington. Hey, Glenn. What's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
You forgot about white phosphorus. I think it burns at about 2,000 degrees. It has to be cut out by a knife or it'll burn its way all the way through you.
Yeah, right. And yes, we have used that as well.
Okay, my thought about your topic today, is this just another sideshow to take our involvement with the coup that just happened in Egypt off the screens?
Or to take Ed Snowden off the screen, or to take...
Ed Snowden,
you know,
yeah. He's sitting comfortably in Russia.
Russia, yeah. Or to take the wind out of the sails of the Republicans who want to, you know, blow up the country again and destroy the middle class so that they can blame it on the Democrats. And
grew up about the same time I did. You know what happens to the block bully? And, it scares me for my grandkids.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, we may have some of the most, you know, best technical weapons in the world, but we can't even get an army right now. Nobody's joining.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think the last thing I heard, the Pentagon spending like $1 billion a month on advertising.
Well, the Germany, it doesn't surprise me. It's an enormous amount of money, but they've got a huge budget. But, you know, and Germany's out there saying, hey, you know, that gas might not have even come from Assad. But even if it did, let's assume that it did. I don't think that our involving ourselves in that civil war is the appropriate response. We should register a loud complaint at the United Nations, period. End of discussion. Let the UN deal with it. And if they don't, like they didn't with Saddam back in the 1980s, so be it. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
CNN, by the way, found that a little over two-thirds of the people who watched the president's speech last night now agree with him. I don't get it. Right, here's another interesting thought. Most of the guys who committed 9/11 were Saudis. Saudi Arabia is now supporting the Sunni rebels in Syria, including, apparently, the Al-Qaeda faction. What's the deal with that? It's just asking. Russia has just sent a carrier killer. This is the headline on RT. Russia's carrier killer Moskva enters Mediterranean. This is a carrier that carries missiles that are, they're called Volcano SSN-12 Sandbox Anti-Ship Missiles, according to the NATO classification, designed to be carrier killers. And they say that Russia's standing naval force in the Mediterranean, now keep in mind, Syria is on the Mediterranean, Russia's standing naval force in the Mediterranean, we have 5 ships there. Russia's now involves landing aircraft carriers Alexander Shablin, Admiral Nevelskoy, the Persevet, the Novocherkassk, and the Minsk of Russia's Black and Baltic Sea fleets, as well as escort vessel Nirtrashmi, forgive my lousy Russian pronunciation, and the anti-submarine ship Admiral Penteliev. it seems like Russia has as much or a larger a naval presence in the Mediterranean off the coast of Syria or in the neighborhood of Syria, or being able to operate off the coast of Syria, than we do. They say, well, it's just normal rotation. We're just moving things around. Jerry in Long Island, listening to WWRL. Hey, Jerry.
Yeah, hi. How you doing? Last week, I mentioned my areas of agreement and disagreement with you, but this week I'm going to mention my areas of agreement and disagreement with President Obama, and I'd like to talk about his speech last night. And first of all, I agree when President Obama said towards the end of his speech last night, when he asked rhetorically, what kind of a nation would we be when a dictator brazenly uses poison gas, including on children, and we choose to look the other way? But, and this is an important but, here's my areas of disagreement with President Obama, and here's where I have a problem. I have a problem with both solutions President Obama is presenting. The first one is his own solution involving using cruise missiles and sending them into Syria. And even the second solution being proposed by Russia that President Obama is willing to look at, I have a problem with that. I have a problem with that as well. I'll tell you more in a second. First of all, with respect to President Obama's solution that he initially proposed and he's still sticking with, still leaving on the table, with respect to lobbing cruise missiles into Syria, the problem I have with that is obviously that I would like to know rhetorically what happens, for instance, after all the dust from any U.S.-launched cruise missiles, if the dust settles and the Syrian people look around and they see both collateral damage, including civilian casualties from these American weapons, and they also continue to see Assad still in power, still killing them, although now perhaps he's doing it with conventional rather than with chemical weapons. And that's the problem I have with the Russian plan, is that the Russian plan...
But see, Assad's... hang on just a second here, Jerry. Assad is only killing his own people to the extent that they're trying to overthrow his regime. I mean, what you have here is a civil war. And if the South, their equivalent of the South, says, okay, we're not going to try and overthrow the North anymore, then the war is over.
Yes, but what if the reverse happened? I mean, what if we had a situation where the North was thinking of surrendering? And
well, if Assad surrenders, if he gives up, and then you've got this free-for-all. Qatar has a government in waiting that they want to put in there that will allow them to run a natural gas pipeline through. Saudi Arabia has their own government in waiting to take over Syria with a puppet government for them. I'm sure the Russians have an idea of who should be in charge. We certainly probably, I guarantee you, we have an idea who should be in charge. I'll bet the Iranians have an idea who should be in charge. And there's no doubt in my mind that the Turks to the north have an idea of who should be in charge. And you're going to, and who gets a hold of those chemical weapons first, and what do they do with them? I mean, you know, if it's the people that are being sponsored by the Saudis or the Qataris, then it could be that those chemical weapons will very rapidly be used against Russia. On the other hand, if it's the people who are being sponsored by the Iranians or by the Turks, you know, it's not inconceivable, remote, but not inconceivable, those chemical weapons could be used against Israel or Lebanon. I mean, it's like sometimes it's better to keep the dictator in place. I hate to say it, at least until you can provide for a rational transition, build the institutions of democratic governance. Yeah, you know, this was the mistake we made in Iraq, where we took out Saddam Hussein, and then we said, and Don Rumsfeld said, "Okay, freedom is messy, have fun," and all of a sudden there's a bloodbath.
But what about all the hundreds of thousands of people he's killed so far with conventional weapons? That's the problem I have with the Russian plan, is it would do nothing to have Assad stop using conventional weapons.
But see, again, let me say it again, Jerry. Assad is only shooting at people who are telling him to stop being president. That's the definition of a civil war.
Actually, he's no Obama. He's not democratically elected, and he's not a benevolent dictator like Jordan is perceived to be, or like the Emir of Kuwait is even perceived to be.
I think that if the House of Saud came under the same kind of military attack that the House of Assad has come under, the response would be identical. I don't think he's a benevolent dictator, but I don't think that the Saudis have a benevolent dictator. I don't think any of those dictators in that region are benevolent. They've just been able to keep the lid on the pressure cooker long enough that it looks that way. And when the lid starts coming off the pressure cooker, then you discover that, you know, no, there's no such thing as a benevolent dictator. In order to be a dictator, they have to be brutal and willing to use brutality in the first place. Saudi Arabia has one of the most ferocious secret police forces in the world. I mean, the way that they brutalize dissidents in that country is mind-boggling. It makes the Chinese look like nice people.
Well, you're right that the Saudis are very brutal, but is the king of Jordan, is he doing any of the things, or is even the king or princess of Saudi Arabia doing quite the sort of
thing? Certainly, I think the king of Jordan is a lot more enlightened than most in the region, but he's still the king. You know, he's not the president. He's not the democratically elected guy. He's the king. Yeah, his wife is an American. I think that might have moderated things. He's Oxford educated. He's a smart guy. But I guarantee you, Jordan has secret police and rubber hose prisons and the whole bit. I mean, you don't be a dictator without that. It's not possible. Jerry, thanks for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and in the studio with us live. And that has a kind of a dual meaning today is Tim Carpenter. Tim Carpenter, the founder and co-founder of Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, one of the great organizations that is not part of the Democratic Party, totally independent organization that is working for peace and for national health care, among other things, but principally those two things. And, Tim, I didn't mention it on the air the last time you were on, but you, 4 months ago, had been given 4 months to live.
Well, I was diagnosed with a reoccurring melanoma cancer in May when I was with you, and I think one personal celebration is I was given a limited amount of time if I didn't get a bridge drug, and I did, and I'm here and excited to be here, and thank you for having us back once again, and this time with a victory, not just with some down news, but good news that we have to report today, so thanks for having us.
Well, with regard to the medical news, just to wrap this up, it looks like the tumors are shrinking. You've got this new wonder drug, and they're going to do surgery. They think they're getting down to the point.
At this point in time, there are no guarantees, certainly with cancer, it's day-to-day, but the good news for me is that I've been able to get on a bridge drug. Unfortunately, millions of Americans who don't have the opportunity, but I did fortunately get on a bridge drug. A wonderful team of oncologists working with us, and things are hopeful. The last PET scan shows that the tumor is definitely shrinking, and some of the concerns that I wouldn't be able to get some surgery to help out are moving. So
there you
it's
go.
A good day of celebration.
It is, and please keep Tim in your prayers. He's been
Thank
in
you,
mine.
Tom.
So Tim, Progressive Democrats of America, there's a victory there, too.
Well, the president wanted, if you set your watch, I think a week ago, the missiles were supposed to be flying into Damascus last week at $1.4 million, and the forced diplomacy seems to be holding at this point in time. So for us in the peace and justice community, this is a day of celebration.
Yeah, and you've got a full-page ad that ran in the, it's
roll
not the Hill,
call.
It's Roll Call. Roll Call is like the local.
Inside the Beltway, this is the publication. So for the peace community, what's important for us is the day of the morning of the president's speech, we had a full-page ad because of members of PDA who sent in their $5 and $10. We were there to say no strike. And so for this, it was a great victory. And then today we had our roundtable. And you've had us now for 6 months following the roundtable. So we just concluded our roundtable.
Okay, so tell us about the roundtable.
As you would expect, Alan Grayson, when we were here last month, there were probably five members we can count on one hand who had the courage to walk the halls of Congress and say there's got to be a better way. Barbara Lee, Alan Grayson, Mark Pocan, Jim McGovern, Congressman Conyers. Barbara Lee, of course, was the leader of the effort to talk about diplomacy. Mm-hmm. And in that time now, through the president's speech and the work of millions of people who took to the streets this past Monday, over 225 candlelight vigils across this country, the American public said no to the president. And the president backed down, came to Congress, and here we are. We just left the halls of Congress. We met with Keith Ellison. We met with Alan Grayson. We have a 30-day, at least hopefully indefinite reprieve. No vote on Syria, and we're hopefully going to give diplomacy a chance. So it's a real celebration.
It really is. This is so different. I remember, you know, when George Bush announced that he wanted to go to war in Iraq, and over a million people went into the streets worldwide, and he basically just thumbed his nose at all of us. I mean, it was the largest anti-war demonstration in history. This time we've got a president who said, make me do it, back in the day. And so we said, okay, cool.
We did it.
Back down, slow down, back off, slow down, and he did.
How many times have I come to you and said our role is to tell this president, and the American public did? Alan Grayson was sharing with us today, anecdotally, walking the halls of Congress, talking to Republicans who said their phones were ringing off the hook, 50-1, 100-1. The American public spoke up very loud and clearly. And what exciting thing I think for us as progressive Democrats, our inside-outside strategy, working the halls of Congress with those five members to move within Congress and out in the streets, more collaboration with Move On and Win Without War and Peace Action and PDA and Code Pink, coming together as a peace community, bigger than just our organizational identity, but as a larger social movement. And I think that speaks volumes, not just of this victory, but we got other victories, hopefully, that are in the horizon. We've got to stop fast-tracking on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We talked about that today. Right. So there's a real coming together that's we had in our meetings today with members of Congress and those working inside, outside. It was a good day.
Is PDA involved in environmental politics at all?
Absolutely. We had just again today, we're organized by issue organizing teams, and we have a team working across the country on the whole question of the carbon tax, the whole question of fracking and the work that's going on there. We had Congressman Holt today talking about the fracking question, what we can be doing in Congress, more importantly, what we can be doing in our local communities. The PDA is very much involved. We believe very much that we have to move to a green economy. We've got to shut down the nuclear power plants. We've got to get rid of coal. We got to get the solar up, and we got to get the wind turbines turning.
There you go. We're talking with Tim Carpenter, the executive director of Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org is
Thank
the
you.
Website. And, you know, visit, pitch in, help out. It's this is just a great organization. The official notification or whatever, I'm an unpaid, unofficial
but we got you.
Member of your advisory board.
Yes,
so
you are
basically
proud.
You can put your name on my thing, my name on your things, and I occasionally contribute something to the organization, which
more
I encourage everybody
just
to
something.
Do.
It's opportunities like this to share with your listeners. I think sometimes you even underestimate your reach, Tom. There are people that are part of PDA that have organized chapters because when we ask them, how did you find out about PDA? I can tell you 6 out of 10 times. And a general public, when we ask Tom Hartman's show, I think you have more of a reach than you realize. And we're proud of our advisory board. It's made up of folks like yourself on the outside and the inside, members of Congress we spoke of that are part of that. Raul Grijalva, the co-chair of the Progressive Caucus. Yeah. Tom Hayden, who wrote the letter. One of the reasons we feel, and Alan Grayson confirmed this, 225 activists took to the streets, went to their congressional offices, met with their members of Congress, and put a letter in front of them that Tom Hayden wrote and said, we don't need this strike. We need this in regards to diplomacy. And that's the kind of activism. And those are the members of our board that are making a difference, like yourself with Tom Hayden, Medea Benjamin from Code Pink, we talked about earlier.
Yeah, Medea is a real warrior. she is such
she's
a champion.
Life energy force under her own right.
She is. She's the Energizer Bunny. I mean, she just never stops.
Well, she's the one that organized the vigil here on Monday night that Alan Grayson spoke at, Win Without War, as I said, and Move On. There's a real coming together. There's been, honestly, some friction in the peace and justice movement. We sometimes get too caught up in our own branding, and sometimes the work suffers because of it. And I can say, honestly, when you have Code Pink leading the candlelight vigil with Alan Grayson, with Move On and Win Without War and PDA, something is truly lining up in the planets or something happening. It's very exciting.
Absolutely, because Code Pink is about as far to the left, for lack of a better phrase. I mean, they're considered one of the more radical elements, you know, willing to disrupt the president's speech, things like that. And on the other hand, Move On is generally perceived as more of the kind of traditional inside the beltway.
Safe. You know, don't push the envelope.
Yeah, right.
And they were pushing Obama. We were all pushing Obama on this one. And that's
everybody
what
came together on this with you guys, with Progressive Democrats of America. I mean, you didn't lead it, but
we'd
part
like
of
to
it.
Be proud. Our joke within PDA is we move on. So if we can get out front and move on, we're very happy with that. And it
that's
was
a marvelous thing. I mean, this is one of the reasons. Actually, the only two national organizations that I have said you may use my name is Progressive Democrats of America and MoveToAmend.org.
Well, we're
that's
on
it. And because I think that there's, you know, a couple of really clean organizations that are really, you know, largely volunteer run and that are doing work on the ground and get it and are actually having an impact. And you're one of those two organizations. And in the area of peace and social justice and everything else, I mean, what Move to Amend works on is, you know, the structural stuff. Let's amend the Constitution.
Well, Citizens United has to be overturned. We work closely with them. There's free speech for people. There's a number of groups. But Move to Amend is certainly one of the groups that's been out front for a long time.
Yeah, they have. So we have a minute left here, Tim. Tim Carpenter, we're talking with the Executive Director of Progressive Democrats of America. What's the next step? What's the call to action? What do you say to our listeners and our viewers about what they can do and what you're going to be doing?
Well, when I began with you, our letter drops. This is an opportunity, the third Wednesday of every month. Go to your member of Congress with a letter specifically on the progressive legislation, whether it be single-payer, citizens' United or the war, potential war in Syria. We're going to be back out delivering letters. Visit the website, pdamerica.org. Learn more about the trans partnership on the TPP. We're going to be working a lot on that, on fast tracking, on the trade agreements. That's the most urgent thing that we need help with. But most importantly, just in the last couple of seconds, visit the website, sign up. If there's something that spoke to you today, be a part of it. Be a part of this growing movement. We work inside and outside, as we said, and PDA is part of the larger social movement. So collectively together, we can make a difference. And I thank you again, Tom, for the opportunity to have us and to be a part of the community. Thank you.
You are always welcome here, Tim, and I hope for many, many years you are.
Thank you. I give it my best shot.
You are a part of this organization, indeed. Tim Carpenter, the Executive Director of Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org. PD as in Progressive Democrats, America as in, you know, us, .org is their website. So check it out. Tim, thanks again for being with us and for the great work you're doing.
Thank
you. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with more of the news of the day, my thoughts, your thoughts, and my comments on your thoughts right after this. Welcome back to Viagra for Your Brain, the Tom Hartman Program. Lee in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you, honey?
I am well, but I'll get better.
I know you will. Basically, this is just a pep talk call to you because I know you're disturbed by all these statistics and these numbers. Mm-hmm. I live in Texas, so please help me. The most fascist state in the United States. I have not met one person that is for this war. All they can do is just shake their head in disgust and shame, and I guess that's where I am. I'm in shame that we have let these people we've elected take over our country.
Well, we elected them to run our country.
Yeah, so what's wrong with us? Did they put something in the water, or do they deliberately keep us stupid, or...
We've been watching this movie repeat itself over and over and over again since the Johnson administration, and, you know, of if you're a president, with a single exception of Jimmy Carter, if you're a president, you've got to have a war to prove you're a tough guy, right? And so, you know, Reagan goes after Grenada. I mean, make it a small war, one that we can win quickly. George Herbert Walker Bush goes after pushes Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait after he encourages him to go in. You know, April Gillespie, yeah, no problem, come on in. Oh, whoops. You know, oh, babies and incubators. We've got, I mean, the babies and incubators story is, in my mind, the analog to the children dying of poison gas story, except for the fact that the babies and incubators didn't happen and the children actually did die of the poison gas. But that said, I don't think you sell a war with a sad anecdote. You sell a war with large strategic issues. So anyhow, bottom line, Lee, you live in Dallas, the heart of red, red, red America, and everybody you know is opposed to this war. And it's not just because it's Obama suggesting it, I'm assuming.
Oh, no, no, no. Obama's not in control. People that believe our president is in control of anything are living in a dream world.
Yeah.
They've got a bunch of people pinning him down. I believe, basically, he might be an okay guy. I have faith in him, but he is being pressured by all these people around him, and I feel sorry for him in a way. But I feel more sorry for us because we are not alert. We are not awake. That is why I'm just so thankful for you, for everyone in production, the woman who put me in the queue. You have no idea what a refreshing moment it is to see people that have access to both sides of their brain.
Well, thank you, Lee. Thank you for your kind words. I'm going to move along and pick up some more calls here, but thank you for your kind words. And I have to say, I am just saddened that our president would think that it's necessary to go to war about an anecdote. I just see a lack of big picture understanding here. Janet in Topeka, Kansas. Hey, Janet, welcome to the program.
Well, hello. I haven't been talking in a while, but Who? What's driving this? I think it's the big banks. And I don't know if you read an article by an Ellen Brown who wrote Web of Debt.
Oh, Ellen, yeah. I know Ellen. I know she recently wrote a piece on Syria. I confess I have not read it. What did it say?
Ah, basically, well, she refers a lot to the research or the journalism of Greg Palast.
Oh, yeah.
That a lot of what's driving all of this is a 1990s plan, Larry Summers, Tim Geithner, these guys, to make a world bank, basically, where what they had to do was break down the glass steeple type conditions in all throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. And they've largely done that.
Well, basically 40% of all the banks in the world are publicly held. Mm-hmm. You know, where they don't have they don't buy derivatives and credit default swaps and all that stuff. Right. The reason they wanted to do this is because they wanted to open up world markets, WTO, to our credit default swaps.
Yeah, there's an interesting article about that in today's Financial Times. And yeah, in fact, the headline is, let me bring it up here. I was just reading it earlier. I actually read this article. Derivatives move from banks into the shadows. And what they're talking about is that with the upcoming Dodd-Frank regulation of bank derivative behaviors, the derivatives market, which is a, you know, multi-hundred, like $700-900 trillion market in the United States, probably a $200 trillion market, it is moving out of the banks, which is the banks are mourning the loss of profits. But, you know, there are some people who are saying the sidelines who are, well, in this article in Financial Times, they're saying we're not mourning the loss of risk. Moving out of the banks and moving into the hedge funds where they're unregulated and invisible. So now instead of, you know, Morgan Chase or JP Morgan Chase, which used to be Morgan Stanley, or Bank of America, or, you know, or Goldman Sachs, instead of them bringing down the country, it's going to be some hedge fund that you never heard of, which is pretty scary stuff. Janet, thank you for the call and thanks for your kind comments. Linda in Columbus, Georgia. We have a minute to the break. Linda, it's yours.
Okay, this is what I think our Congress and our president needs to do is write a letter to every one of these countries that we give money to and tell them it has been rescinded because this is your responsibility to take care of what's going on over there. Mm-hmm. They know who they are and where they're at, and they're not helping themselves by letting them go on and go on and go on and do all these evil things.
Yes, like enabling alcoholics. On the other hand, my big problem with our foreign aid is that our foreign aid is almost exclusively military. I mean, with Egypt, for example, we give them $3 billion a year in foreign aid, and a little over $2 billion of that never even runs through their banking accounts. It goes from a banking account in Washington, D.C. to a banking account in Virginia, where various defense contractors are located. And then we ship them over the goods that they bought from us with our dollars. And that's the form of foreign aid we have. And I think, frankly, what we should say is from now on, we will build schools, we will build hospitals, we will build roads, we will build fiber optic systems. You know, we will give you the infrastructure of democratic governance and a nation, but not weapons of war. Thank you, Larry.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Time for a real serious reconsideration. And by the way, it's the anniversary of 9/11. What do you think happened on 9/11? Okay, the United Nations has come out with a verdict about Syria. This is interesting. This hot off the presses. It's on the front page of the New York Times electronic edition right now. Byline by Nick Cummings Bruce. He talks about how this four-person UN rights panel presented today, Wednesday, detailed evidence of what they said were war crimes and crimes against humanity committed by pro-government forces and, to a lesser extent, by the rebels in the 30-month-old conflict. Syria's government and rebel forces have committed murder, torture, rape, and indiscriminate attacks on civilians without fear of future punishment. The panel, a commission of inquiry that was expanded last fall, said in its latest report, presented to the United Nations Human Rights Council here in Geneva on Monday. The report, Nick Bruce Cummings Bruce reports in today's New York Times, the report was careful to hold both sides responsible. Of the 9 mass killings the panel investigated for the report, 8 were attributed to the government side, 1 to the rebels. Relentless shelling, they said, has killed thousands of civilians and displaced the populations of entire towns. So basically they're saying the government is far worse than the rebels, but they're both doing really nasty stuff. They said the perpetrators of these violations and crimes on all sides act in defiance of international law. They do not fear accountability. Referral to justice is imperative. And we're throwing money at this thing. So it's remarkable. Regularly reported the detention and torture of children as young as 13. 258 interviews to give details of widespread torture, particularly by military intelligence and other security agencies. Mass killing of Shiite residents in the Hatla district of Deir el-Zour in June, according to the panel, which reported summary executions of captured government soldiers and said rebel forces had recruited children for combat. Rebel groups had also conducted torture, the group said. And although those occurred only in isolated incidents, there were strong indications that such practices are on the rise. The main thing, their main point is that both sides have this sense of impunity, that they can basically do anything they damn well please, and nobody's going to hold them responsible. This is, you know, war is hell. War is hell. Chris in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Chris, you have a theory on Syria?
Well, yeah, I mean, put your tinfoil hat on for this one. But okay. If people are going to talk about the pipeline.
Please don't tell me it's Israel. Qatar.
I'm sorry?
I said, please don't tell me it's Israel. I don't see where they have any interest in this region.
Well, here's the thing. People are talking about a pipeline from Qatar to Western Europe and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Israel has recently uncovered massive amounts of gas reserves, and they are in talks with Turkey. They want to build a pipeline and get their gas to Western Europe. So if you're going to entertain the theory that that Qatar is funding the rebels to overthrow Assad because they need to get him.
What's your source of this, Chris? I know that they have found some offshore gas, but you know Israel uses a lot of gas too.
Okay, I can cite some links here. They recently, now I'm looking at it as we speak, so I've got a ton of links open here. But
this is not Alex Jones' website.
Let me give you some numbers here, Tom. Like 18 trillion cubic feet they just discovered in the Leviathan field. They have, where is that? I've got so many tabs open. All right, so they have 12 different fields. The Leviathan I'm talking about is 18 trillion cubic feet.
These are the offshore fields?
The U.S. Department of Energy. This doesn't say whether it's offshore or onshore, but
yeah. Okay.
The first volume they're expecting out of this is in 2016.
Yeah.
Okay, So
in other words, what you're saying is that Qatar wants to build a pipeline, Saudi Arabia wants to build a pipeline. We've known that all along. And now you think that Israel wants to build a pipeline, too.
They're in talks with
Turkey,
and they're admitting it. This is in a Jerusalem newspaper.
Yeah.
And so I'm just saying, you know, it needs...
No, Shano says Reuters is confirming that. It doesn't necessarily mean they're involved in trying to screw up things with Syria, but that's very interesting. They could also, you know, they've got a deep water port. They could build their own liquid natural gas terminal if they wanted to.
Let me expound upon this, because For over a decade now, Israel's been trying to get us to go in after Iran. And if we launch any type of attack on Syria, of course, Iran has this unwritten agreement to protect Syria. Russia doesn't want any pipeline built from any country. So, and knowing that it makes absolutely no sense for the Assad regime to use chemical weapons with this line, President Obama had drawn, I mean, it just seems to me that this would be a great way to get us involved with going into Iraq.
Yeah, I don't think Israel's trying to drag us into this. I think that the rebels are, personally. I mean, I am still of the opinion that this is a so-called false flag operation, as it were, but it's being done by the rebels and probably by the Al-Qaeda faction, the hardcore fanatical Sunnis. But, you know, time will tell. Time will tell. We will see. Chris, thanks for the call. Scott in Santa Cruz, California. You wanted to talk about 9/11?
Yes, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Everything was predicated on 9/11. All the wars that we've been in, Iraq,
right.
Afghanistan, the Patriotic Act, everything has been predicated on the events of 9/11. It has legitimized the whole police fascist state that we find ourselves in right now.
Mm-hmm. I do not disagree with that assessment. Therefore, you're saying that the fascists, the corporatists, the narco state, police state loving folks were responsible for 9/11 because they figured out a way to benefit from it?
No, I'm saying that the people high in our government actually let it happen at best, and at worst made it happen. There's mountains of evidence that show that people high up in our government were responsible in part to what happened on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
There's
well, the let it happen part is substantiated by people like Richard Clark. If you read his book, you know, basically, whether it was by incompetence or malice or whatever, and you know, the most charitable attribution is incompetence. But Sandy Berger told me personally, I mean, he was Bill Clinton's national security advisor, that he told Condoleezza Rice when they made the transition in January of 2001 that her number one priority should be finding bin Laden because bin Laden was going to hit the United States. And she didn't do it. I don't want to talk about my conversation with Al Gore, but, you know, I know that Al Gore was, you know, told the same thing to Dick Cheney, and I was told by Sandy Berger that, and this is all on the record, that President Clinton said the same thing to President Bush, you know, in January when that transition was made, is look out, Osama bin Laden is coming to get you. And, you know, I tried to take him out. Remember, he threw those three cruise missiles into Afghanistan to take out Osama bin Laden's, I should call him bin Laden because I do that slip so easily. We all do, I think, to take out bin Laden's training camps. And, you know, Newt Gingrich goes on the floor of the House of Representatives and starts yelling about, oh, look at that. He's just trying to wag the dog. He's trying to avoid impeachment. And, you know, no, he was seriously trying to take out a guy that he thought was planning an attack on America. And so Bush puts Cheney in charge of his counterterrorism task force in January of 2001. And that counterterrorism task force does not meet in January or in February or in March or in April or in May or in June or in July or in August. And finally, in September of 2001, you know, the 9/11 week, right? The first week of September, the counterterrorism task force meets to determine what they're going to do about the possibility that that bin Laden might strike inside the United States. And this was, and then Bush is down in Texas in August, and the CIA sends a special guy down because they think he's not taking this stuff seriously to personally give him a paper titled Obama Determined to Strike Inside the United States. And Bush reads it and literally, I mean, there's testimony to this on the record, pats the guy on the leg or on the butt and says, okay, you've covered your ass, go back to Washington, D.C. And then Bush continues to have the longest presidential vacation in the history of the presidency going back to George Washington. He refuses to go back to Washington, D.C., I think because he knew something was going to happen. He didn't know what it was, and he was frightened by it. But he did not mobilize the National Intelligence Service the way that Bill Clinton had. He had essentially demobilized it. I don't think this was conspiracy. I think it was stupidity. But, you know, George Bush, the greatest intelligence failure in the history of our country was 9/11. You think, Scott?
Yes, on many, many different levels, there were many failures.
Yeah.
And when you look at all the facts,
Well, and then Bush, you know, after taking this long vacation and still Bin Laden had not struck the United States. So then Bush says, okay, I'm not going back to D.C. because, you know, but they had pretty good intelligence, you know, from the Russians, from the Israelis, from the South, from the Brits, that New York and D.C. were targeted. He said, I'm not going to go back to D.C. And so instead he goes to his brother, the state that his brother runs, his brother Jeb, who locks down Florida, and that's where he is when 9/11 happens. Thanks, Scott.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But inside job, no, that's a bridge too far for me. Sorry. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 10 minutes before the hour. And let's check in with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave from South Sudan and receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped at goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today?
Oh, quite a significant amount. House Republican leaders decided today that they would delay, it's all about delaying this week, isn't it? Until next week, a pretty controversial, nay, contentious vote on keeping government funding going past September the 30th. Now, the reason they've had to do this is because they can't get their fractious Republican-conservative conference together.
Really?
Yes.
So, in other words, these, and I'm assuming the two factions are the shut down the government faction versus the, you know, let's just kick the can down the road for a while and focus on other things, you know, talk about guns, gays, and gods or something,
well,
faction.
It's all about defunding Obamacare and shutting down the government and the debt limit and things together. And the idea was, this is Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader's idea. The idea was, okay, we actually want to keep the government running because that's not where we really want to have the big fight. We want to have it over the debt limit. But we also want to give conservatives another vote on defunding Obamacare because it's important to them and they can go home and talk about it. And let's get the Senate on the record.
Right. So they're going to send a bill to the Senate that has a piece that the Senate can remove from it after they voted on it. They can remove it by voting it out. That says, let's defund Obamacare, and then, oh, by the way, let's kick the can down the road. Here's your continuing resolution.
Exactly.
That will pass, and it won't have to come back to the House, so it'll go right to the White House for it to be signed. Government continues to operate. Everything is fine. And the Republicans in the Senate can go home and run for reelection in 2014 saying, yes, I voted to defund Obamacare. Yes, indeed. I'm one of them.
Right, but Republicans in the House have revolted and have balked and have said, no, wait a second, this isn't real.
This is purely symbolic.
This is symbolic. That's
but wait a second, those same Republicans have had 40 purely symbolic votes to repeal and defund Obamacare themselves. How can they complain about sending a symbolic vote to the Senate?
They want a real vote about really defunding Obamacare and really shutting down the government.
Well, it's going to be a real vote when it gets to the Senate. It's just going to lose.
I know, but they don't think it's real enough. So anyway, they're going to delay it until next week.
Right.
Meantime, all House Republican leaders, the big ones, are getting together tomorrow to talk about the upcoming fiscal fights, including, of course, the debt ceiling, which comes up mid-October. And by the way, by November the 5th, Guy Fawkes Night in Great Britain, we're going to be in very serious trouble.
Guy Fawkes would be proud.
Guy Fawkes would be proud. From October the 18th to November the 5th, there are big payments due October the 23rd, November the 1st. The Treasury has to make a $58 billion payment to Social Security recipients, Medicare providers, and active duty military. So the idea is that this is something that does need fixing. But Eric Cantor floated an idea yesterday in a private caucus meeting that what they should do is to delay Obamacare for a year and then raise the debt limit and offer some sweeteners to Democrats.
Yeah, that's about as likely to happen as a snowball is to exist in you know where.
That's the current plan.
That's is this Is this bluster? Is it naivete? Are they blinded by the? I mean, don't these guys, the Republican leadership, don't they get it that America is in pain? That I mean, these are the guys who want to cut off food stamps when most of the people in the country who are depending on food stamps are rural white Americans.
There is a real belief by conservative Republicans in the House that Obamacare is an atrocity and needs to go.
Right. But they think the same thing of Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. I mean, but they can't defund those because everybody knows what those are, and people, there's a broad consensus, people like them. What they're really terrified of, Victoria, correct me if I'm wrong, is that Obamacare will go into effect January 1st and people will like it.
I think they feel that window is closing rapidly.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
Very interesting to watch all this. What else is going on?
Separately, Secretary of State John Kerry heads to Geneva tonight to discuss Syrian chemical weapons with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, to test the seriousness of a proposal to destroy Syria's chemical weapons. Our goal here is to test the seriousness of the proposal. Eyes wide open is what the State Department spokeswoman is saying. I think they're fairly skeptical. He will not be discussing the UN Security Council resolution. That's being done separately.
That's being worked out between Russia and France?
Russia, France, and Britain in the Security Council. And China is starting to talk also and is indicating
good.
That it's not in favor of a military attack at all.
This is getting more and more interesting. What was the nation, is there any good measure of the nation's response to the president's speech last night?
It's very interesting. What I've read so far, and I've scoured the papers for this, very muted response from nations, actually. It's kind of a universal, meh.
Yeah, but what about the American people? What's their response?
The American people, blah.
Huh. Yeah. Well, he sort of did come, basically his speech was, killing kids with chemical weapons is bad. We should slap the hand of people who do it. We shouldn't punch them in the face, just slap their hand. And let's wait to do it.
That's correct. One last thing, an interesting Military Times survey of more than 750 active duty troops, these are career enlisted members and officers this week, found that 75% of troops are not in favor of airstrikes and 80% do not believe getting involved in the civil war is in the U.S. national interest.
Wow. And that was done by the Army Times?
Done by the Military Times.
Military Times.
Online survey.
Fascinating. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Victoria, thank you for an excellent news report, as always.
Thank you.
Great talking to you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Well, it's the 11th anniversary of 9/11 today. And so, of course, this is Rudy Giuliani Day in New York, at least if you ask Rudy Giuliani. And lest we forget, some of the most powerful and famous people in America had some very strong opinions about why roughly 3,000 of our fellow Americans and citizens from, as I recall, nearly 100 countries. I mean, I don't know if there were citizens from 100 countries, people who hailed from, many of them American citizens. Anyhow, this was a very broad swath of America was killed in the Twin Towers on 9/11. Not to mention the strike on the Pentagon and the plane that went down in the field in Pennsylvania that in all probability was headed for the White House, which is why George Bush was hiding out in Florida, in my opinion. Not that he knew that that was heading for the White House, but he figured, hey, it's like something's up and it probably has something to do with the White House. So some of the most esteemed, respected, high-profile commentators in the United States were Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell. And they immediately, I mean, right after, I think it was the day or two after 9/11, took to the airwaves to share with us how it was 9/11 was happened because in this country we allow gays to be gay, we allow women to get abortions, we allow women to vote, and I don't know, something else. Well, you can listen for yourself and figure this one out, see if it makes any sense. I'm curious your take on it. And Pat Robertson's still on the air, still holding these views. Jerry Falwell's passed into the light, and he's hopefully now awakened to the fact that we are all one and that he was such a silly guy on Earth. But anyhow, here they were 11 years ago.
What we saw on Tuesday, as terrible as it is, could be minuscule if in fact God continues to lift the curtain and allow the enemies of America to give us probably what we deserve.
Well, Jerry, that's my feeling. I think we've just seen the antechamber to terror. We haven't even begun to see what they can do to the major population.
I mean, the ACLU's got to take a lot of blame for this.
Oh, yeah.
And I know I'll hear from them for this, but throwing God off successfully with the help of the federal court system, yes, throwing God out of the public square, out of the schools. The abortionists have got to bear some burden for this because God will not be mocked, and when we destroy 40 million little innocent babies, we make God mad. I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America, I point the finger in their face and say, you helped this happen.
Well, I totally concur.
And there's Pat Robertson's very end. Well, I totally concur. So, because these groups help secularize a country that was birthed in being a secular nation, where twice in our Constitution we assert, we are not a religious state. We are not a theocracy. There shall be no religious test for anybody, for any job in or position with any government. And the position of the United States with regard to the establishment of an official religion is no. We are a secular state. We were formed as a secular state. We were created as a secular state. Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson come out and say, God punished us with 9/11 because
the homosexuals and the lesbians and the People for the American Way and the ACLU and the, you know, try to secularize America.
And what amazes me is that 11 years on, and I mean, even at the time, there was this, how can you say this? But part of the how can you say this response did not, by and large, in the corporate media in America, and I was paying attention, did not say that very, you know, did not react to that very last part, that Falwell was saying that the whole reason that this happened, that God allowed 9/11 to happen, was because we had become a secular nation. These guys were arguing for theocracy. They were arguing for a government run by the religious, you know, where the highest authority, excuse me, I'm sneezing. They always come in threes. The highest authority in the United States would not be the Supreme Court, would not be the president, would not be the Congress, but would be a religious body that oversees things. Or that our laws would be constructed in such a way that the Supreme Court would have to enforce religious law. This was their pitch. And there was nobody seemed to catch that. And that's still their pitch. You know, as I said, Falwell's gone on to the great beyond, but this is still their sales pitch. Listen, you guys want a theocracy with a veneer of democracy underneath it? You want a country where you can have a president? Sure, and everybody can vote to elect him. You can have a parliament. Everybody votes to elect them, you know, the equivalent of a House and a Senate. Sure, no problem. You can have local democracies. You can have a Supreme Court. But at the very top of the whole thing, there's this group that has the final say on everything, and it's a small group of religious people, the Jerry Falwells and the Pat Robertsons of the nation. If you want to see a country like that that has been operating on those terms since 1979, take a look at Iran. Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and the whole bunch of these theocrats who are still doing this, right? Let's put creationism in our textbooks. Let's teach that evolution is just this theory. Global warming isn't really happening. People used to ride around on the backs of dinosaurs. All this stuff. These people are all calling for theocracy. Involve the government and religion. You got the governor of Maine, the governor of Virginia, the governor of Florida, the governor of Texas. Say, you know, well, the biggest, Bobby Jindal down in Louisiana, saying, let's give state money to religious schools. Clearly a violation of the Constitution and the intent of the founders. These people want the United States to turn into the Christian version of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And increasingly, the people of Iran don't want the Islamic Republic of Iran. They held an election a couple of months ago, and they elected the most liberal guy running. Now, again, it's a theocracy. The mullahs didn't let the real liberals run, but so the most liberal guy running was sort of a kind of Bill Clinton, middle-of-the-road Democrat kind of guy. But and I guess we sort of do that here, too. You know, it's the major parties tend not to put forward really, well, actually, they do put forth severe candidates. The Republican Party had John McCain. Democratic Party once had George McGovern. So occasionally they slip through. But in any case, the point is that he was overwhelmingly elected. The people of Iran don't want a theocracy, by and large. They want a modern, thriving, secular, pluralistic country. And yet we've got people in America who call themselves Americans, who call themselves patriots, who want to turn America into a theocracy. And meanwhile, in the midst of this, the rich are cranking the whole thing. I'll tell you about that after the break.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, the rich are really cranking this thing. It's like they got these various front groups, and the theocrat folks are one of them to just kind of keep them in power, you know? I find this very, very interesting. The editorial page editor's blog. Juliet Lapidos is writing for the New York Times. The editorial page editor's blog. And she's reporting on a new analysis of IRS figures. These are not, you know, hey, some liberal think tank. This is the Internal Revenue Service. The analysis was done by economists at UC Berkeley, the Paris School of Economics, and Oxford University. Hardly partisans. And what they found was that in 2012, in other words, the election year, when Barack Obama occasionally talked about, you know, helping out the middle class, and Mitt Romney said, oh, you're engaging in class warfare. You're picking on me because I'm a rich guy. In that year, last year, the election year, the income of the top 1% of Americans, people making over roughly $350,000 a year, the income of the top 1% of Americans rose nearly 20%. The top 1% of Americans took home 19% of the entire nation's paychecks. And the top 10% of Americans, which would be people, roughly everybody making over about $140,000 a year, if my recollection is correct, took home 48.2%, about half of all the income in the country was the top 10%. Meanwhile, the income of the bottom 99% grew a measly 1%. It's mind-boggling. So what do the rich do? Well, they fund groups like the Heartland Institute to say, oh, we need creationism in our school books. We need to be backing up those theocrats and those crazy people out there who are saying, yeah, America, you know, the David Bartons of the world with their alternative histories of America. Yes, Thomas Jefferson was actually a raving Christian, didn't you know? It was secret. So secret he didn't even write it down in his diaries. Or if he did, oh, here's the quote. I just made it up myself. Right. You know, the rich will always find shills. They will always find somebody who's willing to speak on their behalf if they're paid well enough. Dan in Seattle, you have some theories on 9/11, this being the anniversary.
Yeah, you kind of went over them earlier, talking about President Clinton, President Gore, both, or Vice President Gore, both are on record saying the number one thing that Bush and Cheney needed to be concerned with was Al-Qaeda. And they didn't do a damn thing. I mean, that's just it.
In fact, they put on hold all the efforts that the Clinton administration had started because they had to prepare for their war with Iraq.
Yeah, and the thing is you'd kind of gone over that a few times. Now, let me put something in perspective that I think our listeners will enjoy. Mm-hmm. Imagine if it was Al Gore who was in the White House, ignored hundreds, if not thousands, of in-your-face direct warnings that we're about to be hit, and then 9/11 happened with Al Gore in the White House. They would have hung him on the White House lawn.
Yeah, Al Gore and Bill Clinton would have both been impeached the next day by the Republicans in the House of Representatives, and there would have been calls for public executions of Sandy Berger.
Yeah, that's the difference between them and us. They're rabid dogs. They, you know, it's just unbelievable. And Bush, what has Bush paid for his crime? That's 1,000 murders on his hands. I don't think he was involved, but he obviously wanted us to get hit. Look at what he did after we got hit.
I don't think he wanted us to get hit. I think my personal take on this is that he knew that there was going to be a hit. He didn't have any idea it was going to be as big as it was. I think he was genuinely horrified by the loss of life. He thought that it was going to be like the blind shake. You know, they're going to try and blow up the World Trade Center and 10 people are going to die. It's going to be that kind of thing. And he just didn't want to be in town when it happened. Or they're going to try and, you know, catch the White House on fire or something. And or they're going to assassinate somebody. I mean, I think he thought that's what was going to happen. And he just didn't want to be around when it happened. And he was pleased to make use of it when it happened. But I don't think that he in his wildest dreams believed that they would fly airplanes into those buildings. I mean, Condi Rice came out and said that. Although, here's the thing that gives the lie to what I just said, right? Let me contradict myself. A year earlier, or not a year earlier. 4 months, 5 months earlier, it was in March, I think. It was either March or June of 2001. There was a G8 or G12 or G whatever it was meeting in Italy, as I recall. And the president, George Bush, went, but instead of staying on land, he stayed on an aircraft carrier every night during that meeting. And the reason that was publicly given by Condoleezza Rice at the time, and if you dig deep enough, you can find the old clips of her saying this, was that they had intelligence that Al-Qaeda or other extremist groups intended to hijack commercial airliners and fly them into the hotel where President Bush was staying in Italy for the G whatever it was meeting. And so when she later said, we never imagined, could have imagined, that they would actually fly an airplane into a building, I think she might have been being disingenuous. On the other hand, you know, she might have thought, hey, yeah, it can happen in Italy, but there's no way it's going to happen in America. I mean, the ability of people to deny reality. What do you think, Dan?
I'd like to add, if possible. From what I understand, America's wealthy have $50 trillion in assets. And if they're sniveling about raising the debt ceiling, all this and that, the wealthy in this country, from what I understand, could pay off our entire national debt, and they wouldn't even miss the money.
Well,
so when they're cutting food stamps, when they're cutting $40 billion from food stamps and claiming it's because of fraud, like the 1% of fraud that goes on,
right.
It's just insane. We don't need to cut food stamps.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And thank you, Dan, for the call. And Jesse Jackson the other day said in a meeting of a strategy meeting with the NAACP that we need to whiten poverty in America, and we really do. We need to help white people in America realize that the majority of food stamp recipients in this country are poor white people.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Why is that? Why would you say that? Because white voters tend not to care about what's going on with black people, which is a sad legacy of racism in this country. Very, very longimanously ugly. The good. The Saratoga Hospital. On Monday, the upstate New York Hospital unveiled its newest facility, a multi-million-dollar community health center in downtown Saratoga Springs. It will provide services to the underinsured. Although Obamacare will offer Americans more choices regarding their health care plans starting this January, there are still some loopholes. And that's where the Saratoga Community Health Center comes in. In fact, the facility will help people get the care they need regardless of coverage shortfalls. Hospital officials actually expect the new center to operate at a loss, but say it's important to help the underinsured get care regardless of cost. Good work, Saratoga Hospital. The bad. Alex Billington. The American blogger really doesn't like movie talkers and movie texters. In fact, he thinks they're criminals. Billington got so annoyed by people talking and using their phones during the Toronto Film Festival earlier this week that he called the cops to report them. Yes, he actually called the police to report people using their phones at the theater. Billington first said he was just trying to stop piracy, but has since admitted that he really just wanted the police to stop people from texting. You know, if Alex is worried about annoying theatergoers, he might want to take a look in the mirror. And the very, very ugly Neil Cavuto. While the rest of the world is trying to soberly analyze all the different scenarios that could come about as a result of an American strike on Syria, Neil Cavuto is spending his time talking to conspiracy theorists about whether the Syrian conflict is part of biblical prophecy. No, I'm not making this up. Check it out.
This just in, the Syria stuff is way old. I mean Old Testament old. That's how old I'm talking about. Don't laugh. Some biblical scholars say it's all there in black and white. Like this spooky passage from Isaiah 17 about Syria itself. Behold, Damascus is about to be removed from being a city and will become a fallen ruin. That's a couple of thousand years ago. Another passage warns of growing unrest in Egypt and the rise of a fierce king.
I guess this is what passes for breaking news over at Fox so-called news these days. And that is very, very ugly. Phew. Amazing. Amazing. Joe in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind?
Oh, hi. Yeah, thanks. First, Al, on about 70% chance, I agree with you, and I agree with you on this whole Syria thing. I do think it shows that instead of fighting libertarians more, we should probably try to work with progressives, at least where we have agreement. And I think another thing it shows is how willing Obama is to ignore the law when it's something he doesn't like. I mean, we've seen it over and over again with the U.S. law and the Constitution, and now we're seeing it.
Well, hang on just a second here, Joe. In 1974, Congress passed the War Powers Act, which said that if the president wants to have a war, he can have that war. He just has, I think, 6 months. He's got a certain period of time in which he has to go before Congress and ask for permission for his war. Bush did this with Iraq after the fact. And this was all based on Nixon having bombed Cambodia. And they wanted to say, okay, Nixon, you're not going to be prosecuted as a war criminal. This was in 74. That law is still on the books. Congressman Peter DeFazio is on this program today talking about how he's trying to amend the War Powers Act to get rid of that so that the president doesn't have the power to go to war because he thinks it's unconstitutional. It's never been litigated. It's never been before the Supreme Court, to the best of my knowledge anyway. And it should be. But the fact of the matter is that under the 1974 War Powers Act, Obama does have the legal authority to strike Syria. He just has to, within 6 months after that, go to Congress and say, is it okay?
Again, that's assuming it's constitutional.
Yes.
I mean,
I agree. I agree. And I think it's not constitutional. And I think Obama thinks it's not constitutional. And that's where I have to congratulate him. He said, I'm going to take this to the representatives of the American people, to Congress. I mean, that was an incredible act of courage on his part.
The only reason he did that was because the British Parliament turned it down and he got cold feet. He would have.
I don't think so. I don't think.
Oh, there is no way. I mean,
Joe, 98% of Americans have no idea what the British Parliament does.
He wouldn't have made himself look like such a fool if that hadn't happened. I mean, he would have said it right away.
I disagree. I totally disagree. Had he simply gone in and dropped a few bombs on Syria and then dusted his hands off and said, well, that's all done with, he would have gotten the same kind of bounce that Reagan got when he bombed Grenada or when he invaded Grenada.
No, he wouldn't have.
Why not?
Because we're sick of war. We've had the disasters in Iran and Iran. We have the disasters in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Okay, you're right.
And this is extremely unpopular
right
from the get-go.
But I mean, if he did it without any blowback, I mean, look at what happened in Libya. He took out Gaddafi with NATO support. Libya has now descended into chaos. Libya is far worse off than it has been in decades.
Exactly.
But nobody knows that in America. So people think that Libya was a successful operation. They so think it that last night the president cited it in his speech.
Yeah, and I'm with you on that. What did we get out of that? More chaos.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, we got Benghazi out of that.
Yeah, but I think we all have to be honest with the people that we support in general. And call them to task on stuff like this. You know, Obama has shown, particularly with his willingness to flout the domestic law, is just astounding. You know, what he's done with Obamacare, letting the corporations off for a year, there's zero legal authority for that. None. Nobody could say.
Actually, there is legal authority for that, Joe.
Okay, the
executive branch does not have to enforce the laws that Congress passes. They can choose not to.
Okay.
They're
so
supposed to enforce them.
If a Republican came in and said, a Republican president came in and said, I'm just abolishing all EPA regulations. I'm going to shut down the entire EPA and do nothing. That would be okay?
It would be legal. He couldn't do it like that. He would have to do it the way that Ronald Reagan did and that George W. Bush did, by saying, we're going to reduce the funding for the enforcement mechanisms of EPA. And move that funding to administrative functions or put it into a savings account or whatever. We're going to change the way EPA works. We're not going to enforce these rules. We are going to enforce those rules. This is done all the time. It's done with the IRS constantly. It's done with the EPA. It's done with every federal agency.
Constitutional law. That is not. A president does not have the power to basically void any law he wants to void. I mean, it's.
Well, I'm not talking about voiding a law. I'm talking about not enforcing a law. I mean, the president has come out and said he's not going to enforce the law on for young people who are in this country without documentation or citizenship.
So what does Congress have to do then? What good is a congressionally passed law if the president can just decide which provisions to ignore?
If they think that his ignoring the law has risen to the point of a real horror show, the option that they have is to impeach him.
Where is horror show in the Constitution?
Well, you know what
I'm
saying.
And what would you impeach him under? You're saying that if a president had...
You would impeach him for failure to perform his duties of office.
But that's not a high crime or misdemeanor.
Well, I believe that's what Andrew Jackson was impeached for.
And they were saying that was a high crime not to...
Well, that he was not performing the functions of his office. I mean, Andrew Jackson was a Democrat, and you had the radical Republicans try to impeach him after the Civil War because he was not gung-ho to go into Reconstruction.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've just seen a disturbing trend in the last 15 years. You know, Bush passed with Democrat help, got the Patriot Act pushed through, which incredibly expanded... federal government power, and now Obama is doing even more, And the left is quiet when a Democrat does it in general.
I don't
and,
think that's true.
And the right is quiet
I think
when
we have been
Republican.
Well, I can't speak for the left. All I can speak for is myself. And I have been speaking out loudly on these issues for a long, long time. Joe, I share your dismay in some areas, but you know, I think that we also have to acknowledge when things are done right. But anyhow, we'll continue this conversation. Joe, thanks for the call. Jay in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Jay.
Hi there. I just have one other possible theory on what we've been observing for the last 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
And President Obama is a very smart man. And I think he's quite aware that if he's for it, a majority of the House and a lot of the Senate are against it. And I think we've seen a very sophisticated, complicated game of Brer Rabbit saying, whatever you do, don't throw me in the briar patch.
Right. So he drew the red line, which was a mistake, because he made the same mistake Jack Kennedy made in 62.
I think the let's bomb.
Here's my point. He drew the red line, and then they started saying, well, you know, you drew that line, now enforce it. And so then he says, okay, cool, let's bomb them. But I'm going to throw it to the Republicans in the House.
Knowing that if he said, this is what I want, if I'm for it, they're against it.
Right.
And right. I think we've just seen some very sophisticated gaming, very dangerous gaming. But I think we've watched a really interesting process here.
I think you may well be right, and this is what I was speculating about yesterday. And in fact, the question for, I think, our third hour was, have Obama and Putin punked the Republicans? You know, have they beat the Republicans at their own game? And, I think the answer may well turn out to be yes. And there have been some other benefits from the point of view of the White House, not from my point of view, like Ed Snowden and the whole NSA scandal is off the radar screen. Nobody in Congress can get a quorum together to change those laws and rules, things like that. But, Jay, I think you may well be right. Thank you for the call. It's 15 minutes before the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. And we'll be back with more about Syria and 9/11 and 9/11 and 9/11 and Republicans and Christian nations. Well, we've got a lot of interesting calls coming. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And by the way, hasn't it been a good thing that Obama has provoked a national debate about Syria? Bush didn't have a debate about Iraq. The music that you hear is by Victor Jara, J-A-R-A. Today is 9/11. And Victor Jara, on 9/11 in 1973, when Augusto Pinochet took over Chile, there was a 9/11 in 73, too. It was the revolution, as it were. It was the takeover of the government by a brutal military dictator, who then brought in Milton Friedman. Yesterday I was explaining to you Milton Friedman and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and this cabal of billionaires and multimillionaires invented the idea of libertarianism and the modern-day Libertarian Party back in 1946 in order to promote business interests. Well, after Pinochet took over the country, he was like, okay, I got this country, now what do I do? And the Chicago boys, Milton Friedman and his libertarian buddies, said, oh, we'll show you how to run the country, privatize Social Security, privatize everything, do away with public functions, and just let the market take care of everything. People didn't like that. They protested. And what did Pinochet do with with a blind eye from Milton Friedman and his friends? They murdered people like Victor Jara, the guy that you were just hearing. He was murdered by the Pinochet regime for standing up to them. Nice testament or nice memorial for him over at democraticunderground.com, by the way. So, Chris in Chicago. Hey, you had some thoughts on Syria 9/11? Chris?
Hello?
You're on the air.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
I'm listening.
Are you there?
I am listening.
Well, first off, there was 28 pages Bush sealed. For the first 9/11, and Obama promised to release the 28 pages to all 9/11 families. and the American people never did. Okay. And in that 28 pages, there's a Saudi connection to Prince Bandar as far as supplying the 9/11.
How do you know that if it's never been released?
Attackers, parts of it has been, and Senator Congressman let it out. And then there's a letter that came to Boehner Friday from the head of the Syrian parliament explaining that they should be dialogues before they start bombing them and stuff.
Right.
And then they were explaining how Syria is one of the last countries in the Middle East that are fighting jihadists, like we're supposed to be.
Right.
But, I mean, now we're going to bomb them, and they're the only country to fight. I mean, Libya, Gaddafi, before he got they got him out of office, he vowed no al-Qaeda operations in Libya.
Right.
Now, you know, then he's gone. And Egypt, Muslim Brotherhood, Obama backed the Muslim Brotherhood getting in, running Egypt. That's
right. Well, Muslim Brotherhood and al-Qaeda are not friends. They are enemies.
Well, not totally. They're pretty much allied.
No. No, they're competitors for political power.
I beg to differ, but they are allied. And anyway, and then there was Syrian gas, and there was some of these supposed freedom fighters in Syria that got caught in Turkey with 2 kilos of Syrian gas. That was the Syrian that wasn't aerosol.
Right.
They didn't make it aerosol, but it was
right.
2 kilos of it, enough to kill 1 gram will kill a person, so they could have killed 2,000 people with it.
Right.
But the Turkish police got that. And then another thing is all this is coming down while they're trying to get the Section 2 of the Dodd-Frank bill in. Article 2, Section 2, where the bail-ins start.
Right.
And that's, the country's bankrupt, and then the bail-in is, right?
No, I don't.
Oh, the bail-in is where they take the unsecured creditors, which is everybody who has money in the bank. You're an unsecured creditor, and they take your money and use it for the bail-in. And then the bank's supposed to run meaner and leaner, and it's all nonsense.
Right, right.
And then the second thing is...
But we're still covered by the FDIC, so it's...
If
you have under a $250,000...
If you've got over a $250,000, they're going to take your money.
Right.
And then the next thing is, do you know what the wording is for the Glass-Steagall Act?
They for the what?
It's called the Glass-Steagall Act.
Oh, the Glass-Steagall Act. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know the exact wording. I know the intent and effect of it.
It's in the Congress as it's H.R. Bill 129, and it's called the Prudent Banking Act.
Mm.
Well, what it says is the banks will return to prudent banking, not to infringe on the rights of the American citizens, pursuit of liberty and happiness.
Right.
So now, why isn't Obama doing? You know, he's known since he's been in office to reenact this and refused.
Right.
And, I just...
We'll have to... Chris, I want to get some other voices in here, but thank you for the call. We'll have to see how this plays out. Preston in Denver. Hey, Preston, what's up? Thanks for listening to AM 760.
Thank you. And thanks to Tina for her amazing, insightful words.
Yes.
And truthful. And, yeah, we are one. And making space for the grief for ourselves and the grief of others. I'm thinking of the people in Iraq right now. And, as upsetting as the video we've been seeing is to all of us, to see the images of children affected by our use of depleted uranium is even more upsetting because we're responsible for that.
Mm.
We've got scientists and engineers getting all kinds of money to create weapons of mass destruction. Agent Orange, MOAB, mother of all bombs, cluster bombs. The people of Vietnam, in addition to the Agent Orange, they're dealing with hundreds of thousands of unexploded bomblets that children come upon.
And they are in Iraq as well, by the way.
Likewise, exactly. So,
and presumably Afghanistan.
Introspection can be hard, but it needs to be done. And it's so good to see it is being done. I mean, I think social media is really having an impact. I think some people, by all the NSA stories, can be kind of scared away from it, but they're still using it, still sharing links. The Zinn books are selling. Progressive radio has expanded the conversation, and democracy begins in conversation. That's what John Dewey said, and Dewey's kind of like the...
That's a great quote. John Dewey. Right. Democracy begins in conversation. I love it. Preston, we're out of time, but thank you for your thoughtful comments, and thanks for listening to AM 760 there in Denver. We'll be back tomorrow with the latest on Syria, plus what requires more strength, dropping bombs or exercising restraint. I'm going to be challenging conservative former Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy, Seth Cropsey, on this. Plus, we'll be talking the top issues of the day with Mike Papantoni of Ring of Fire Radio and Geeky Science. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.